where we don't have a blue light, anyway.
There it is.
Whoa!
I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection. It's Monday, May 11th. Got four bills up before us today, and we're going to start out with Senate Bill 438A. Victoria, you want to give us a brief little summary of Senate Bill 438A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 438A defines organization for purposes of determining credit union membership, increases maximum loan that may be made by credit union to member of credit union's management team without approval of board of directors from $25,000 to $100,000, requires that credit manager, if appointed in lieu of a credit committee, be appointed by the credit union board of directors, increases amount of fidelity bond required of credit unions. This bill passed the Senate Business and Transportation Committee unanimously and passed the Senate unanimously.
Thank you. And up first, we have Pamela Levitt, Scott Burgess, and Hal Scoggins. If one of you would like to identify yourself for the record and begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 438 today. As your wonderful committee administrator said, it did pass the Senate 30-0. So we will be brief, but we do want to give you a background on the bill. This bill is a two-year process. Every year we review the Oregon Credit Union Act to determine how can our credit unions serve their members better in your communities. And this is the bill that is in response to that. There are several technical changes, and we'll go over quickly some of the bills. Some of the language in the bill. I just want to quickly say that Oregon's 83 credit unions employ 4,500 Oregonians in all 36 counties in this state, with $170 million in salaries and benefits. And we have $11.3 billion in loans out to Oregon consumers. I think in this economy right now, those numbers are always important to share. This committee specifically has heard a lot about the mortgage lending crisis, and just want you to know that credit unions are certainly not immune to what is going on out there, but we are doing very well. Our credit unions are reporting that they are hiring temporary workers in the mass to get loan modifications and refinances out the door, and we're quickly helping those Oregon consumers with their home mortgage needs, and certainly will, in my testimony, I provided you a little bit more background. I have our attorney and one of our CEOs who will go over Senate Bill 438. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing us this afternoon. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt, with the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon and a number of credit unions throughout the state of Oregon. And you have my written testimony. I won't bore you with the section by section of the technical details of the bill. There are a number of technical changes, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. What I thought I'd focus on right now is the one, what I would call non-technical provision of the bill, which deals with field of membership. And the reason that we put this change into the bill and are asking you for this change is several years ago, Oregon became one of the many states that allows credit unions to have a geographic charter, a community field of membership, where the credit union serves members who are located within a specific area. A number of credit unions who were occupational-based credit unions serving particular employer groups converted from occupational to community charters due to competitive pressures and a number of reasons like that. And what they discovered is that in doing that, the way that the previous legislation was written, they had to give up those relationships with employers who they may have served in some cases 50, 60, 70 years, but whom the economics of the current marketplace simply don't permit the credit union just to focus on that employer anymore. And In giving up that relationship with that employer, what they found is that, for instance, they could continue to serve members who work for that employer and are located within the geographic area, but a credit union may serve an employer that's got employees in several different cities around the state, some of which are out of the credit union's geographic area. But the employer wants to maintain that relationship, continue to offer credit union membership as a benefit of employment to its employees. And so we're coming back to the legislature saying if an employer is within the field of membership group that is served by a credit union, so an employer is located within that particular credit union's geographic area, that we're changing the definition of organization so that the credit union can not only serve the organization but also employees of the organization, even if they're located outside that particular geographic area. If they're paid from or employed by that employer, then they would still be within the credit union's field of membership. And you'll hear from Mr. Burgess what that means to him and his credit union, and provides a good concrete example. But this is not a dramatic expansion of field of membership. This is really primarily to allow credit unions who converted from an occupational charter to a community charter to continue to be able to serve those employers that they have been serving for a long time. I will stop now and let Mr. Burgess continue, and we'll answer any questions there.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Scott Burgess, and I'm the president and CEO of Rivermark Community Credit Union. I'm also the chair of the State Issues Committee of the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to testify before you. I guess the first thing that I'd like to talk about is a little bit about the process by which you've got a bill before you, some of the background. As the chair of the State Issues Subcommittee, it's a very collaborative process. We bring several credit union CEOs and representatives from around the state, four state-chartered credit unions together, and we meet every 2 years or whenever you're in session, and we always want to meet with the objective of assuring that the state law or our Oregon Credit Union Act provides us the tools to best serve our members. And we recognize that there are constantly changing things going on out there with the financial landscape, the changing economy, and so we recognize that the financial needs of our members are changing as well. So we want to make sure that we're always reviewing the Oregon Credit Union Act and that we have something in place that's going to provide us the tools to help serve our members, and that's our sole purpose. I'd like to give you a little bit of information about Rivermark Community Credit Union. We're based out of Beaverton, Oregon, and we serve approximately 46,000 members. And as a community chartered credit union, we serve those members who live or work in a six-county area, a geographic area, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington County, Marion, Yamhill, and Polk County. So we serve the Portland metropolitan area, Newburgh, and Salem area. We were founded in 1951 as Safeway Credit Union, so if Rivermark doesn't ring a bell to you, for 53 years we operated under the name Safeway. So we changed our name and converted to a community charter in 2004 and became Rivermark Community Credit Union. Up until 2004, we primarily served employees of Safeway stores and their families under an occupational charter. And that's important, as I want to talk a little bit about the field of membership aspect of the bill. So I want to take a few moments today to talk about a few of the components, but particularly as it relates to the field of membership and how it would have a positive impact on Rivermark Community Credit Union and the members that we serve, and other community chartered credit unions that are state credit unions. The most significant part of the bill relates to, obviously, field of membership. We're very excited, I think, about this. I want to give you an example of how this is going to help us. And as I mentioned earlier, in 2004, we converted to a community chartered credit union, and we changed our name from Safeway to Rivermark. And then prior to that time, Rivermark, or Safeway at the time, we served specific employee groups across the state of Oregon. Safeway stores, however, was our primary employee group, and the vast majority of our new members originated from Safeway stores. When we made what I felt was a very difficult decision to convert to a community charter and change our name, and it was difficult because of the competitive pressures that has been alluded to, not to mention the fact that we had a 53-year relationship with Safeway and under the Safeway brand. But we made, ultimately, this difficult decision to convert to a community charter. And at that time, Oregon law required and still requires that we would limit our new membership growth to those that live or work in our six-county area. So we could no longer provide as a benefit new membership to employees and family of Safeway stores that happen to be located outside of our geographic community charter. So we essentially had to pull out of Safeway stores that we had previously served in Medford, The Dalles, Bend, all across the state of Oregon, and that was a difficult thing. All of those stores, by the way, are under the umbrella of Safeway's Portland division, which is located in Clackamas. So this proposed change in the field of membership in Senate Bill 438 would, if applied to Rivermark, allow us to continue to provide the benefit of credit union membership to those employee groups that we had when we converted to a community charter. And that would be, of course, with the blessing of the regulator on a case-by-case basis. You know, credit unions like Rivermark, I think, are doing some great things for Oregonians. You may recall that the credit union industry in Oregon was one of the first, if not the first, industry to step forward and offer low-cost alternatives to predatory payday lending. We've always been known for having low-cost financial products and services, and we continue to make smart, well-thought-out, well-underwritten mortgage loans. We have basically stayed the course and gone with what has made us successful over the years and made our members successful. So giving us the ability to continue to provide the benefit of credit union membership to our existing employee groups would certainly be, in my opinion, a very strong positive, both for the credit unions and also for the members that we serve and the consumers across the state. I hope that gives you a good real-life summary of the field of membership piece of the bill and how it would be a positive impact to consumers and to community-chartered state credit unions. The other components of the bill are fairly straightforward, but they're nevertheless very important. Again, when we meet every 2 years, we're wanting to make sure that we have the tools in statute that are going to help us best serve our members. And some of these additional changes are simply intended to help us focus on what we're there for, and that is to serve our members. So I certainly could answer any questions, should you have any. That really concludes my testimony. I want to thank you again for giving me an opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and seeing you don't have any new amendments to this bill that I see before us, and it looks like it was pretty uncontroversial on the other side. But I do have a question, and not for any other reason, but just to provide myself with some background. And I was wondering if you could, or if one of you could talk about, I guess it's on page 6 of the bill in section 8. Subsection 3 of the bill, where it talks about the director, officer, committee member may not become a surety or guarantor for a loan. And then it goes on to talk about that they can do that for their spouse or children. Can you just talk about that for a little bit, about what's the history behind that and the differentiation between the member themselves or the person themselves and their family members?
Sure. Chair Holby, members of the committee, again, this is Hal Scoggins. And the larger backdrop to this issue is that loans to insiders, and in this case specifically directors, are, of course, a sensitive issue, and it is other people's money that's being loaned. And so credit unions have to take special care when they are making loans to insiders because of the potential for undue influence. And so there's special rules for loans to directors. And the specifics of this exception relates to approval of loans, but more specifically here in this exception, of loans that would be not directly to a director, but would be guaranteed by a director. And so essentially the prohibition is any loan that is going to be guaranteed by a director has to be subject to these additional protections. However, there's also a recognition that, you know, people have family members, kids, other relatives that they may guarantee a loan for that are really ordinary course type transactions. And just because a son or a daughter gets a car loan and the director happens to guarantee it, is not necessarily going to trigger additional precautions being taken. It's other loans that would be guaranteed by a director that would be, again, more outside the sort of normal family course of business. I don't know if that answers your question, Chair Holby.
Well, I think you gave me an example of the, I guess, the exception for the family member, but it seems like a pretty broad exception for the family members. And maybe I'm reading more into it than there really is, but I was just kind of curious about the why. I understand why the restriction on the director or the committee member, but when you're talking about the family member, then it seems like they don't need the approval of the board of director for that. So I'm just, where do you draw the line, I guess?
Well, Chair Hovey, in determining where to draw the line, and actually I would also point out that this particular change in this section is not really a substantive change. This was actually a technical wording change that was put in by legislative counsel, not to change the actual effect of what was already there. But I think that the line drawing was done in a way that says transactions that are outside the family have additional scrutiny. Transactions inside the family are innocuous enough that the legislature has determined that there's not a cause for increased scrutiny of those transactions. Since that was done a number of years ago, I can't specifically address why the line was drawn there as opposed to someplace else.
Okay. And I recognize that it's really not a change in policy in the statute. It's just putting it in different words. I was just kind of curious about historically how that came to be. Representative Raleigh, a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the membership area, do I understand that even though you're a six-county or north, basically northern Oregon, northwestern Oregon, institution, that this bill would allow you to have members because Safeway has their headquarters, Oregon headquarters, in your district, you would be able to have members from Safeway all over the state?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, yes, that is true. Because the Safeway Portland Division is located in Clackamas, which is within Clackamas County, we would apply to our regulator for a request to be able to serve all employees of Safeway in Oregon. Yes, that's correct.
Chair Holvey and Representative Riley, this change came about when a credit union like Scott's, but also others around the state, made that business decision to change to a community charter. But as Scott said, there were a 50-year relationship with these employees of Safeway throughout, outside of the new county area. And so our credit unions ask, you know, we'd like to continue this relationship. It does have to be approved by our regulator before that they can serve that. So there will be scrutiny on the new membership eligibility.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, if I could just add, that is a part of the process of field of membership for any credit union is it is written into their bylaws, and every change to those bylaws that deals with field of membership or anything else actually has to get approved by the regulator. And so the Department of Consumer and Business Services will be looking at the scope of that relationship of those members or potential members to the credit union, the credit union's ability to serve them, the credit union's past history of service to them, all of those types of things will be subject to review of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
That question is more curiosity than anything else. I'm a member of credit unions in three states, so but I'm just curious.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pam, in reading your materials, mm-hmm. you had mentioned that credit unions did not cause the financial crisis, but the members have been affected by the crisis. Mm-hmm. And also, you mentioned that you're not part of the subprime housing meltdown. So can you talk to us a little bit about that? We had hearings regarding the banks, and could you talk some about the difference between the credit unions and the banks and how you were not as affected as the banks were and you weren't a part of that subprime lending?
Chair Holvey and Representative Tomei, that's a big question, but I will do my best to answer it. As most of you know, credit unions are not-for-profit financial cooperatives. They're owned by their members. We began by, you know, one member at a time, and generally credit unions were built out of people coming together. So it's the members, when Scott's Credit Union or any of our credit unions make lending decisions, and we're specifically talking about the mortgage industry, you know, you're making decisions on a membership-to-own cooperative basis. And so we feel that credit unions made very strong, prudent decisions during this time and were not loaning to individuals who didn't have the ability to repay that loan. Certainly, our members are losing their jobs. Our members are have loans in other financial institutions, have mortgage loans, and our bottom line is certainly being impacted. But I think the credit union model of the not-for-profit cooperative really helped us through this financial time because we were not, our lenders were not giving loans to certainly anyone. And we feel very strongly over the last several years that we had very strong prudent lending practices that we had 10 years ago, that we had 5 years ago, and that we still have today. When you go and get a loan, we're certainly going to make sure, because it's not our money, it's our members' money. So I don't know if anyone else has a better answer to that.
I may follow up?
Follow up, please.
And I don't know if you should go to Pam or somebody else, but we heard in talking about the banking crisis earlier in this committee that very often it's hard to track loans, mm-hmm. that once a loan is made, it will be bought by another conglomerate and then by a larger conglomerate mm-hmm. and a larger conglomerate. So do credit unions hold on to their loans so that they don't go off in the ether somewhere?
I can answer that, but does anyone else want to?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, I think the best way to answer that is to say that it is largely credit union by credit union mm-hmm. basis, unique to each credit union. In the case of Rivermark, we, for asset liability management reasons, balance sheet reasons, we book all of our adjustable rate mortgages and we sell our fixed rate mortgages on to Fannie Mae.
What does that mean?
We'll talk about services.
Chair Holvey,
what does that
Representative
mean?
Tomei,
mm-hmm.
I can perhaps answer that question. And you have to remember that mortgage loans now are essentially separated into two parts. There's owning the actual debt, you know, who gets to keep the money when it's paid, the payments as they come in, but then there's also the servicing of the debt.
And those two things are often separated in the mortgage lending area today. And so when Scott speaks of selling a mortgage loan, the loan can either be sold off to another party who owns the whole thing, and the borrower gets a notice that says make your payments now to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Or what often happens, and I don't have statistics on how much it happens with one segment versus another, but credit unions are very attuned to the member relationship and maintaining that relationship with their members. And even if the right to receive the payments is sold off, often the servicing remains with the credit union. So the credit union would actually still be the party that receives the payments, has contact with the borrower, and then behind the scenes, the credit union forwards money on to whoever has purchased the actual principal balance of the loan. And sometimes the servicing of the loan is sold as well. But I think, in my experience, more often credit unions want to hang on to that servicing because maintaining the overall member relationship is very important to them. I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. But if I can just ask, I don't know what you use the term to book. I don't know what that means.
Is this on?
Yes.
Well, by booking it, we are retaining the loan on our balance sheet. We keep the loan at the credit union.
Got it.
And when we do sell loans, the fixed rate loans on to Fannie Mae, we do retain the servicing, as Mr. Scoggins referred to.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to Section 8, if we can, because I share some of the Chair's concerns, actually quite strongly, but a different section of Section 8 than what the Chairman referred to. Specifically, Section 8, Subsection 2B. Essentially what this, it will quadruple, no, am I misreading it? Because it strikes me as more than just a technical change.
Chair Holvey and Representative Barton, I almost just answered that question in anticipation of a question. But that is not a change. It's a change in the statute.
Yes,
in administrative rules, it's been $100,000 for a few years.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, to elaborate further, if you go down to Section 4 of that same, I should say Subsection 4 of that same section, what that Subsection 4 does is give the DCBS the authority to essentially go above the $25,000 that is in the statute and set a different limit by rule. And for, I guess, probably 6 or 8 years now, that limit has been $100,000. And the reason that we put this change in was that very confusion. I get several calls during the course of a year where a client says, okay, wait a minute, the statute says $25,000, but I knew it was $100,000, but how come the statute says $25,000? Are we in trouble? And nobody remembers that the rule actually has increased the limit from what is in the statute, and that's the reason we asked for this change, was to avoid that confusion.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair, not a question so much as a rhetorical question for us. To the extent this legislature chooses to delineate this limit, which is certainly our prerogative, I cannot fathom why we also then delegate authority to the director of DCBS to essentially, if this legislature decides that the limit should be $25,000 or $100,000 or $1 million or whatever, that's certainly our prerogative. Why does DCBS then quadruple it? We should either just delegate authority to DCBS or do it ourselves.
Good rhetorical question, I assume, Representative Barton, and I imagine that sometimes I'm just guessing that the legislature hears a number that seems to be appropriate at this given point in time, but recognizing that circumstances and economies change, and perhaps the Department of Consumer Business Services may be able to respond to needed change quicker than we could. I'm not saying that's a great reason, but
I don't see the purpose for both, Mr. Chair. We could do one way or the other, each way defensively, but the fact that we have both...
Next session, put in a bill.
Oh, I think I shall, actually.
Representative Riley, is that your comment? Would you care to comment on that, perhaps?
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, I think you hit on it exactly, Chair Holvey, when you said that economies and circumstances change. And I think when the original limit was put in, the idea was that will get your average director a couple of nice cars. And as of today, that probably won't even get one really nice car. So that was the reason for the increase. And even at $100,000, that will get equity loans, but it's not going to buy a mortgage for anybody. So I think that's where DCBS has gone in terms of the change.
Thank you. And seeing no other comments or questions, I appreciate your testimony on this bill at this point. I think that, barring anything else, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 438 and open a work session on Senate Bill 438A. Committee, I think I'm, notwithstanding Representative Barton's concerns, I think he makes a good point, but I think I'm comfortable leaving the status quo in this arena as such, and would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move Senate Bill 438A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 438A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
You know.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Callan.
Excused.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holvey.
Aye. Senate Bill 438, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Consent calendar committee?
Absolutely.
I think not, Mr. Chair.
You think not?
Absolutely no. It's a very significant change we just made.
Okay.
I didn't mean to volunteer to.
he's looking for some FaceTime, I believe.
Well, we'll have somebody carry it. Would anybody volunteer to carry this bill?
I represent, or I.
You want to carry it? Is that what you're saying?
No.
You're looking at me,
right? Represent Barton.
Very well. I'd be pleased to.
Well,
I guess.
I don't know if he has some questions about the bill. But,
Mr. Chair, my concerns can be addressed in a separate. It's not with this bill so much as an underlying delegation of authority that I think is somewhat absurd. But this bill will not change that. I'm happy to carry it.
Okay, I just want to make sure
Thank
you're
you,
going
though.
To be supportive of the
it.
Bill is all.
So, we rely on
with,
you.
With that, Representative Barton will carry the bill. Thank you.
That's good news for the country.
Representative Barton. I'm sure you will carry it with great zealous intent. So with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 438A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 239A. Victoria, would you care to give us a brief summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 239A requires trustees to record affidavits of mailing and service given to grantors required in a foreclosure. Adds a 60-day time limit for grantor to assert that notice was not given. Changes reference to property upon which a trust deed was foreclosed from the statutory reference of Section 20, Chapter 19, Oregon Laws 2008, because after foreclosure, a property is no longer subject to the trust deed. Declares an emergency, effective on passage. This bill passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee 401 and passed the Senate unanimously.
Thank you. And up first we have Gary Blackledge. All right. Hope I said that right, from the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gary Blackledge. I'm an attorney practicing in Portland. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Debtor-Creditor Section in support of Senate Bill 239. Apologize for my voice. I'm a little froggy this afternoon. In 2008, House Bill 3630 passed, which amended the Oregon Trust Deed Act to provide for an additional notice to be sent to the grantor of a trustee who occupies the property as his principal residence. Section 20 of that bill basically required this notice to be mailed to the grantor, and yet there was no proof provided for in House Bill 3630 that the mailing had actually been made. So consequently, title companies and third parties don't know if the notice has been made. And so what Senate Bill 239 will do will require the trustee foreclosing the trustee to record an affidavit with the notice that they mailed to the grantor, just as the trustee must record an affidavit that he mailed the trustee's notice of sale, and the trustee must record affidavits of publication and other affidavits prior to conducting the sale. This is important so that the title companies and third parties looking at the record will know that this notice has been sent and can therefore not show a cloud on the title to the property after the foreclosure sale. The other important thing that Senate Bill 239 will do is in Section 21, House Bill 3630 provided that if a grantor is not mailed this notice, he will have the same rights as... thank you. He'll have the same rights as a junior creditor or person who had another interest that was inferior to the trustee that was foreclosed, and it would survive the foreclosure and therefore remain a cloud against the title to the property. What Senate Bill 239 will do will require that a time limit be placed on the grantor to raise the issue that they didn't get the notice to 60 days after the purchaser of the property at the foreclosure sale takes possession. House Bill 3630 didn't have any limitation on this, and so even if the grantor doesn't ever raise the issue that he didn't receive the notice, and he didn't actually receive the notice, this would remain a cloud on the title, which would require the purchaser at the sale to bring a judicial action to get rid of it, even though the grantor, the trustee, may not be asserting anything with regard to the property. The 60-day time limit in the Senate Bill 231 was a period that was negotiated with the consumer advocates that were responsible for the passage of House Bill 3630. It's important to know that in this situation, these notices apply where the grantor or the trustee actually occupies the property. So we believe that the purchaser at the foreclosure sale, after they purchase the property, are going to go to the property to try to get possession of it. And so that's why it's important that we have the period starting 60 days after the purchaser actually takes possession of the property from the grantor. That way the grantor, the trustee, has a 60-day time period within which to learn what their rights are and find out that, oh, I was supposed to get a notice. I can raise that issue now. All they have to do is raise that issue with the purchaser of or the trustee that did the foreclosure or the lender that was foreclosing or any servicer of the loan that was being foreclosed, and that automatically extends it. And then the only way for the purchaser to deal with that would be to give that grantor the opportunity to step up and pay and resolve it somehow. And so we feel that these are two really important and necessary changes to House Bill 3630, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Questions, Representative Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The notice, first of all, I guess two questions. How does one know that the notice was received? I mean, we know we sent it. We don't know it was received. And how does the person who was supposed to receive the notice know he was supposed to receive a notice?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, the notices are sent via first-class mail and certified mail.
Both?
Yes.
Okay.
First-class, there's a presumption of delivery under the law, and then by certified, even if they refuse it, you will know, but at least there's a presumption that the first-class mail was actually delivered. And then how do they know that they didn't receive the notice was an issue that we struggled with the advocates of House Bill 3630. And we basically arrived at a 60-day period of time because that would give a person plenty of time after they were evicted or otherwise dispossessed of the property to seek advice if they thought that they had some kind of, we don't want to move or whatever, they could seek advice and find out that we should have received a notice, and then they can notify any of the parties, and that would make it so that their interest as a omitted lien creditor, hypothetical lien creditor, would remain.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So, if I'm the person who took possession of this property and I'm going to, you know, kick these people out and I know they didn't receive a notice, I'm going to wait 60 days before I go kick them out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, that it's 60 days after you've kicked them out. So,
that's what I wanted.
Okay, that's what we wanted. We wanted to give them as long a time as possible after they know that they're no longer going to be able to remain in their house.
Anything else?
Well, where does it say that it's 60 days after they're dispossessed? I thought it said 60 days after the sale.
I'm sorry, I don't have the actual...
Line 32, line 31 through 34.
Thank you.
Okay, I see that. Just brief follow-up.
Follow-up.
So what does it mean, takes possession? Does that mean that I've received the deed? Does that mean I've moved in? It certainly doesn't mean I've moved in. Does it mean that I've told the people who are living there that they have to move? I don't know what takes possession means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, we had a lot of discussion over that and decided that was the best terminology that would be all-encompassing. It's not just taking the deed. It's going in and it's asserting possession and control over the property. It doesn't mean moving in, but you know, many times, if an investor purchased the property at the foreclosure sale, and he goes to the property and he wants to fix it up and rent it out to somebody, he wants these occupants in there to get out. So he's going to tell them to move out, and if they just move out and give him the keys, he's taken possession. If they don't move out and he has to bring an FED action against them, and then they still don't move out and he has to execute on the eviction judgment and have the sheriff carry him out, then he's taken possession. So it's whenever that last act would be where he actually has control over it, could rent it out to a third party or do what he wanted with it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Quick question here.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, particularly when you're losing your voice.
Sorry.
I wouldn't wish laryngitis on anyone, but Representative Tomei.
But
I wanted to make sure, are we talking about a particular section of foreclosures? Because this part of the law always confuses me. Are we talking about trustees? Is that just the term we use because it's being foreclosed on? Or are we talking about just properties that are being handled by a, quote, trustee or an estate by a trustee? Just make sure you can clarify that for me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. Yes, this is a specific kind of a security instrument that's like a mortgage. It's a trust deed where there's a trustee that's given the power of sales to foreclose these instruments non-judicially. That's not through the courts. And so House Bill 3630 that was passed in 2008 only affects residential trust deeds and their foreclosure non-judicially. And the residential trust deeds are those that the grantor actually occupies as his principal residence when the foreclosure is commenced.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions? And hopefully, Representative Gilliam, you weren't impugning the integrity of Representative Tomei's voice or her right to free speech.
Hopefully.
Make a note of that.
Yeah, please do, Mr. Chair.
I don't see any other questions for you today. Thank you very much for your testimony on this subject. I appreciate you trying to bring some clarity to this for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 239A? Or Senate Bill, excuse me, Senate Bill 239A. Not seeing any at this time, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 239A and open a work session on Senate Bill 239A. Representative Riley, entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 239A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 239A to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holvey?
Aye. Senate Bill 239A, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. And Representative Riley, you want to carry this bill?
Sure.
Representative Riley will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 239A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 240. Victoria, will give us a brief review of Senate Bill 240.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 240 limits the use of Social Security and driver's license numbers to the final four digits in judgment documents and liens and limits required information to birth year instead of birth date. Limits use of Social Security numbers to the last four digits in writs of garnishment. Provides for disclosure of full Social Security to garnishee if needed to identify debtor. Protects garnishee from liability for mistakes when relying on the last four digits of Social Security number. Declares emergency, effective on passage, applies to documents recorded after effective date. This bill passed, was voted out of the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously and passed the Senate 2703.
Thank you. And up again from the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor selection, this time Mark Comstock.
Thank you, Chair Holdme. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I appear in front of you on behalf of the debtor-creditor section. This is a non-controversial bill. The purpose of the bill is to clarify statutes in Chapter 18 to clarify that in a judgment document that is submitted to the courts and entered in the court record, that the last four digits of a Social Security number are to be included if known, not the entire Social Security number. It is to address the identity theft potential of a judgment document. It also provides that the date of birth is only the year of birth, not the full date of birth, and that Oregon driver's license or any driver's license is limited to the last four digits in the judgment document. It also provides that in a lien record abstract, which is a document that is based upon a judgment to make the judgment effective in another county, that the judgment also requires only the last four digits. And finally, amends the statutes dealing with writs of garnishment to make the last four digits of the Social Security number inclusive in the writ of garnishment instead of the entire Social Security number in that writ of garnishment. The bill does provide that if requested, a garnishee may ask the issuer of the writ of garnishment to provide the entire Social Security number to be able to make sure that the identity of the judgment debtor is verified for the writ of garnishment. That's specifically to make sure that all of the John Smiths that may have accounts at the banks, that you know which John Smith and which John Smith's accounts are subject to the writ of garnishment, so all the John Smiths don't have money taken out of their accounts by a writ of garnishment. And with that, I have submitted written testimony that explains the history of this bill and why it became mandatory with judgments, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I thank you for bringing the bill forward and coming to testify. I support the bill entirely. One question, I noticed actually in the SMS that it was discussed on the Senate side, is the emergency clause here. Because there are a lot of lawyers who, for example, are not necessarily members of the debtor-creditor section, but occasionally, for the benefit of, as a courtesy to a client, will do a garnishment or help them out with a garnishment or something. And it's entirely possible that if it was an emergency clause, they might be violating the law, and they won't even know about it for a few months until sort of the bar does its end of session updates. It just seems like this is a perfect bill. It's crying out for taking effect on January 1st.
Chairman Holvey, Representative Barton, the reason for the emergency clause was to bring the statutes into compliance, well, probably a bad word, with what most of the practice is in the state by lawyers, because most lawyers have limited to judgment documents, limited to the last four digits in the Social Security number in their judgments, and also in writs of garnishment. So that's the practice, if you will. To avoid having what has happened in a few other states, and that is, had judgments challenged with whether or not they comply with the statute if you don't have the full Social Security number in it. So what we've done here is, if we have an emergency clause, if the practice is to put the last four digits, your judgment document or your writ of garnishment is not likely to be challenged.
Brief follow-up. First of all, I'm glad to hear that's common practice. I can tell you, I don't even know what my own practice is. I don't know what the firm's forms look like. I think most of us, that's how most of us who occasionally dabble in this area of law, I think practice. We have a set of forms. To the extent there's a judgment that might be challenged in the next 6 months, because of that, it strikes me as unlikely, but even if it did happen, all right, I hear what you're saying. That doesn't strike me as a potentially huge problem, the judgment being challenged. And it does seem like we might be inconveniencing general practitioners around the state somewhat for 6 months.
Chairman Holvey, Representative Barton, I agree with you that it is not a huge potential because there has not been a challenge in Oregon, at least that has been reported, to a judgment. And I can tell you that there are thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, that have truncated the Social Security numbers in judgments. It is that potential that we didn't want to give anybody ideas. And I can tell you, as one of the editors of the Oregon legislative book put out by the Oregon State Bar, we will make sure that the notice is out as soon as possible.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, I'm glad that you're concerned that attorneys might be caught breaking the law. So, any other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 240? Not seeing any. I thank you very much for your testimony today. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 240 and open a work session on Senate Bill 240. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 240 to the floor to pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves Senate Bill 240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment and maybe a question for you as the chief consumer advocate in our House. Have we thought about this for other documents, other aspects of state government? If this is truly a identity theft protector, maybe we should be thinking about it in a broader sense.
Yes, I believe there was another bill that was brought up, if I remember correctly, but not sure as its disposition did not get through. I think there were some issues with it, but it actually made some steps backwards in protecting identity, believe it or not.
We need another run at it.
Yeah, it wasn't real clear. So thank you for the thought, though. Maybe it's something we should continue to look at. Any other discussion? Not seeing any. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Excused.
Representative Cowan?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Winger? Aye. Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Yes, could you recall Representative Barton?
Representative Barton?
Aye. We're trying to.
Chair Holby?
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe everyone's voted. With that, while we're still open, Representative Cowan, we're on Senate Bill 240 and have had everyone vote aye. And curious if you'd like to cast your vote on that bill
Mr. Chair.
This point.
I vote aye.
Thank you. And I believe I already voted. So Senate Bill 240, having received the required votes, has moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Gilliam, thank you for volunteering to carry the bill.
My pleasure.
And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 240. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on... excuse me for just a moment. I want to go ahead and take care of this. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 438A, and I'd like to have the rules suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Cowan to vote on Senate Bill 438A.
A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote aye, and I apologize for having to be in another committee hearing.
Quite all right. Representative Cowan votes aye on Senate Bill 438A. Doesn't change the outcome of the vote. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 438A and open a work session on Senate Bill 239A for the purpose of suspending the rules to allow Representative Cowan to vote on Senate Bill 239A. Is there any objection to that suspension? Seeing none, Representative Cowan, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Cowan votes aye on Senate Bill 239A. Not change the outcome of the vote. That I will close the work session on Senate Bill 239A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386A. Victoria, would you please review Senate Bill 386A for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 386A makes attempt or threat to collect debt that person knows or should know does not exist an unlawful collection practice. Adds communicating false or misleading statements to list of unlawful collection practices. Makes violation of federal debt collection laws a violation under state law. Allows award of attorney fees to prevailing debtor. Allows award of attorney fees to prevailing debt collector if action by debtor is brought in bad faith or to harass. Declares emergency, effective on passage. This bill was voted out of the Senate Consumer Protection and Public Affairs Committee 3-2 and passed the Senate 16-14.
Thank you. And up first, I believe we have a good senator on a meet sheet.
I started to stand up before you called me. I thought maybe I'd be last.
Not in our committee. Well, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. It's good to be back with the House Consumer Protection Committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is the northeast corner of Washington County and northwest Portland. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 386 as amended. Mr. Chair and committee members, there's a Federal Debt Collection Practices Act, which you might have heard about when learning about debt collection issues. And I wanted to share with you one of the purposes that's stated for that federal act. It is the purpose of this title to eliminate abusive debt collection practices by debt collectors to ensure that those debt collectors who refrain from using abusive debt collection practices are not competitively disadvantaged, and to promote consistent state action to protect consumers against debt collection abuses. And that's really what Senate Bill 386 is about. Oregon's statute, Oregon's Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, was passed in the mid-1970s. And in the Senate committee, when we heard this bill, we heard testimony that the Senate bill was passed, the Oregon State Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was passed with the support of the collection agencies and their industry group. It was essentially modeled after the federal act, and it really does make sense from a policy perspective that we should have a level playing field so that the companies that are following the law are not competitively disadvantaged. And I want to emphasize that that's likely to be most of them that are following the law, but there are some that cross the line. And Senate Bill 386A changes the Oregon Fair Debt Collection Practices Act as follows. And first I want to note that the bill that passed earlier in the session, the other debt collection bill, Senate Bill 328, that gives the Attorney General the authority to enforce the act as it exists. It didn't make any changes to the act itself. Senate Bill 386 is to strengthen the act in a couple of ways. And first, there's a prohibition against collecting debts that do not exist if the debt collector knows or has reason to know of the fact. And the reason this change is in there is because there's been to address a couple of issues. One of them is victims of identity theft, and the other is debt buyers. There's been a proliferation of these debt buyers who subscribe to the sort of sue first and ask questions later method of doing business. And in my written testimony, I have a quote from National Consumer Law Center talking about how debt buyers have learned to work the system to win judgments and coerce payments even when they have the wrong person or lack any evidence that the consumer owes the debt. Even when the debt collector violates the law, the chances of being caught are minimal and the consequences are cheap. And so to address that issue, 386 will create an incentive for collectors to actually take steps to make sure that it's a valid debt before they sue the Oregon consumer. And I want to emphasize that this provision is not intended to apply to situations where there's a debt that is owed, but there's a dispute about the amount. There's an example that, well, what if, for example, there's an allegation that the consumer owes $1,000 and they go to court and the judge says, no, you only owe $800. Well, that's not a debt that doesn't exist. That's a debt. There's a valid debt. There is a dispute about the amount. That's not what this is about. This is about debts where the collector actually knows that this is not their debt because they have been a victim of identity theft, for example, or they didn't take steps to validate that that was their debt. Next, currently, if you look at the law as it exists now, it prohibits profane, obscene, or abusive statements. Now, frankly, I have a little bit of concern about whether those are actually constitutional. I don't think they've been challenged, but this bill adds a statement that prohibits false or misleading statements. And now that's an established body of law. There's a lot of statutes, for example, in securities law and other debt collection practices statutes that prohibit false or misleading statements. So we added a prohibition against false or misleading statements. Now, I want to emphasize that this does not change the requirement that the plaintiff has to prove that the collector willfully violated the law. That's part of the requirement in the existing statute. So at a minimum, the consumer would have to show that the collector knew or should have known that the representation was false or misleading. So it doesn't cover, for example, inadvertent errors. The law currently provides that if there's compliance with the federal law, it's a violation of the state law. This bill simply balances that by saying if you violate the federal law, you also violate the state law. And I wanted to add that there's a difference, though, that the federal law is called a strict liability statute, and that means that if there's a violation, there's liability. Under our law, as I explained, the plaintiff still has to prove that there is a willful violation. So this doesn't change that. The plaintiff still has to prove that it was a willful violation. Finally, Senate Bill 386A changes the attorney fee provision to conform with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Attorney's fees are awarded to the consumer, first of all, only if they prove their case that it's a violation of the act, and against a consumer only if the case is brought in bad faith or solely for purposes of harassment. Now, you have to keep in mind that the statutory damages under this act is only $200. That, as far as I know, has not been changed over the years. Without this attorney fee provision, consumers would find it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to find an attorney to help them assert their rights under the law. Now, it has been suggested, it was brought up on the Senate side in discussions about this particular bill, that this bill isn't needed because consumers can complain to the Attorney General or they can go to the Federal Trade Commission. The Federal Trade Commission enforces the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Well, you know, the Attorney General, even though we passed Senate Bill 328 and that bill was signed by the governor, the Attorney General doesn't represent individual consumers. And if you recall, that bill had no fiscal impact. And so they're really going to be bringing the egregious cases. But for the individual consumers, your constituents and mine, they need somebody to help them bring their case. And so that's what this bill is about. Some of you may know that I used to work for the Federal Trade Commission. So I called and I asked them how many debt collection cases they've actually brought in Oregon in the last decade? The answer was zero. So this is a bill that's needed to help our constituents who are being harassed by people collecting debts in the state. And as I explained, I know that most of them are complying with the law, but for those who do cross the line, this bill will provide a remedy and it will provide access for justice. I respectfully ask that you send Senate Bill 386A to the House floor with the due pass recommendation, and I look forward to answering your questions, depending on who asks them.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, would you answer one of my questions?
Absolutely, please do.
Thank you. No, I am very serious about this question. The prohibition against collecting debts that do not exist or that the collector knows or has reason to know,
right,
that,
right.
How would they know that? I mean, that's what I'm struggling with in my mind is...
Right. Well, if the consumer explains, there's somebody else with my name, check your account, please, check the address, this is not me, this is not my debt,
and they are able to get some documentation of that, that would be a debt that didn't exist. If, for example, the consumer had filed an identity theft report and they gave that to the collector and said, my identity was stolen, that wasn't my debt. Somebody stole my identity, racked up the bill in my name, but here's my identity theft report, I reported it to police, this is not my debt. That's the type of situation that this is intended to address. And I did forget to mention, Mr. Chair and Committee, that I did attach to my testimony a floor letter that the AARP submitted, just so that you have that for your record.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Widener, do you have a question?
Yes. Would you accept a question from me,
Absolutely,
Senator?
Absolutely, Representative.
It must be Representative Gilliam. Okay, my question is, because this looks like it kind of gets after the people that will buy debt as well. So if I'm a business and I can't get the money from them, if I decide to sell the debt to somebody else, they cannot go after that debt for, or either for me or if I sell it to them and give them the debt, and if they recoup something, they do. If they don't, they don't. And the way I'm reading this, they wouldn't be able to do that because technically the debt would be mine and not theirs, even though I sold it to them.
No, that wouldn't, this bill wouldn't address that situation. If you assign your debt to a collection agency or to a debt buyer, the collection agency or the debt buyer has to comply with the law, but this bill wouldn't inhibit that. They would still be able to collect a legitimate debt that you had assigned to them. Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, sorry, sometimes I forget the protocol.
I just, looking at it, because they wouldn't technically own the debt, it would be to the business who originally had it, and that's what I was worried about, if we're going to affect that at all.
That doesn't affect, this bill does not affect that practice. In fact, we just passed, Mr. Chair and Representative Widener, we just passed in the Senate committee the bill that exempts the debt buyers from the registering as a collection agency, and there was a clarification. They still have to comply with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, both the state and the federal, but they still are able to operate as long as they aren't violating the actual prohibitions of the act.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if Representative Gilliam has a question, I'm happy to ask it on his behalf.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chair. Not seeing any at this time. Thank you for your run-through of the bill. I appreciate you showing yourself in front of our committee and presenting it.
It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Up next, I'd like to have Justin Baxter. Good afternoon. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, my name is Justin Baxter. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I'd like to thank you very much for allowing me to appear in support of this important legislation. I've been a consumer lawyer in Portland for going on a decade now, and I've been honored and humbled to represent my neighbors and your constituents in a range of cases. One thing that my practice has taught me is that each and every case is about a real live person, an Oregonian family. And today I'd like to share with you the story of just one such family. The morning of Christmas Eve, 2004, George and Linda Thomas awoke to a phone call. It was a debt collector from a major national bank demanding payment of a bill they did not owe. What ensued was a series of collection calls, collection letters, threats to sue them in court when the Thomases wouldn't pay the bill. It was assigned to a collection agency. More letters, more calls. They obtained Mr. Thomas's credit report without his authorization, all over a bill that he didn't owe. We brought a case in federal court and urged the judge that this was exactly the kind of conduct that this law, the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, was meant to address. Abusive coercion to get consumers to pay bills that they don't owe. The judge disagreed with us. He decided that under an Oregon appellate case called Porter versus Hill, that filing a lawsuit over an invalid debt does not violate the UDCPA. Even threatening to sue or demanding payment, or demanding payment of a bill that is not owed doesn't violate the UDCPA under this line of cases. He entered summary judgment against my clients and dismissed their case. Most tragically, after he dismissed the case, he punished the Thomases badly for bringing the case. He entered a judgment against them for over $50,000 in the bank's attorney's fees and costs. There was no finding that their case was frivolous or in bad faith or anything other than just wrong under his view of the law. I adopt and endorse all of the comments and statements that Senator Bonamici made about this legislation, and I agree with her assessment of what this law will accomplish. In conclusion, I want to say to members of this fine committee that the downturn in the economy has hit Oregonians hard. I see this every day in my practice. Honest, hardworking Oregon families are falling behind on their bills. At the same time, collectors are becoming more aggressive, trying to squeeze that last little bit of money out of people who they think owe debts, whether they owe them or not. This important legislation protects consumers from some of the worst collection tactics, including filing groundless collection lawsuits for bills that people don't owe. I thank you for your time and your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members of the committee have.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin, how much money, if you don't mind me asking, was U.S. Bank seeking from the Thomases that prompted them to file this lawsuit?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, the bank was demanding $3,400.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So was it, what, had their identity been stolen and their credit line had been reactivated by somebody else? What were the circumstances behind this debt?
No. Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, this particular debt had been discharged in bankruptcy over 15 years ago. Well, now going on, I believe, I want to say 25 years. It was discharged in 1989. The circumstances of the case were very unfortunate. Mr. Thomas's small private business was engaged in some intractable litigation over, I believe, a patent dispute or a business dispute. His lawyer at the time told him that the only his only option was to file bankruptcy, but in fairness and in defense of Mr. Thomas, he did something that not every consumer does. He filed a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Rather than just wipe out his debts, he entered into a repayment program. And for the next 5 years, he and his wife paid money into the bankruptcy trustee to try to make good on at least some of his debts. Sometime later, as a result of a bank merger or different parts of the bank not communicating, that discharged account came back to life. And there were so many reasons the bank knew that this was not a valid debt. And Mr. Thomas gave them so many opportunities to stop collecting. He sent letters. He tried to explain his case over the phone. They wouldn't listen. They wouldn't stop.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So was the lawsuit not over whether or not the debt was valid, but just over whether or not they had violated the Unfair Collection Practices Act by
his claim was that they should have known that this wasn't valid. I mean, it was the lawsuit over the attempt to collect it, not over the validity of the debt itself?
Chair Holvey, Representative, fundamentally, yes. The way I talk about the case is that it was about a year out of Mr. Thomas's life. He's over 70 years old now, and at this late time in his life, he shouldn't be burdened with dozens of collection calls, letters, threats to sue him over a debt that he doesn't owe. They shouldn't be pulling his credit report. They shouldn't be reporting false information to his credit report. And even at the time that we had filed our case, he had every reason to believe that they were still pursuing him. It was still on his credit report, and it had been assigned to a collection agency.
One more question, Mr. Chair. So what was the final disposition of the debt itself, this $3,400? And did the judge in this case actually rule on the merits of that debt?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingert, at the point in time that we got well into the litigation of the case that we brought, the bank conceded that this account was properly included in the bankruptcy, was discharged with part of his repayment plan, and was so far beyond the statute of limitations that even if it wasn't part of the bankruptcy, they should not have been collecting it. So that was the ultimate disposition. But again, it's important for me to communicate to the members of the committee that it was only after we brought this case that we knew that it was going to stop. Even at the time when we filed, it was our understanding that the account was still on the credit report and that a collection agency still had the account.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Baxter, thanks for your testimony and you being here today. And it's just it's unfortunate that Thomases are going through this still to this day. If we could fast forward it, this particular case, and now let's say this bill did exist, where would we be if this were to become law? In this case, let's say that were to happen again.
Chair Holvey, Representative Matthews, I think that first and foremost, there would be a regulatory aspect, a leveling of the playing field. I think that this deficiency in the law is understood and recognized by creditors, both in Oregon and outside of Oregon. Collectors, you know, we hear so often that the real bad apples are not Oregon businesses, and I echo Senator Bonamici's remark that the vast majority of businesses in this state are law-abiding and are trying to play by the rules. But having this hole in the law exposes Oregon consumers to exactly these kinds of abusive credit or collection efforts. So first and foremost, I think it would act as a shield to consumers in general. In this particular case, I think that the most important outcome would have been that the case would have survived summary judgment. The jury would have heard the evidence and made a decision. Perhaps we would have won. Perhaps we would have lost. But Mr. Thomas would have had his day in court and been able to tell his story to a jury of his peers.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today, and appreciate you bringing your example forward for us to hear. Thank you very much. Up next, I'd like to have Keith Carnes and Sherry.
Collet.
Cherie. Cherie Collet. Boy, I messed up both the first and the last name.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Members of the committee, I'm Keith Carnes, and I brought with me one person I've come in contact with who's a victim of identity theft, and I'd like her to start by explaining her story first.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is Cherie Collet.
I am recently a victim of identity theft. My ex-husband had all of my personal information and used it to charge up approximately $80,000 worth of credit in his name and under my name. And when he was discovered what he had done, he committed suicide. And I began contacting the credit card companies and all the people that I could see on my credit that didn't belong there. And I gave them all of my personal information, my contact numbers at work, my addresses, my home phone, things like that, to try and help them get this cleaned up because, you know, I wanted to make sure that my credit had already just started to go down the tubes because he wasn't making the payments, obviously. So I had no idea that they would turn that around on me and begin collection activity against me. They started calling me at 7 o'clock on a Sunday morning. They were sending me collection letters saying that I had failed to make my payments. They, in as much as called me on my work line, just harassing me, 4 and 5 calls a day, saying, you know, why haven't you made the payments, things like that. And when I would tell them, you know, look, I've filled out your paperwork, I've filed affidavits of forgery, I have filed credit, whatever the fraud reports with the credit, all three credit bureaus, and I'd say, you know, do you not check your notes? I'm not sure why you're even calling me, you know. I'd have phone calls from the fraud department, and then I'd have phone calls from the collection department. And I'd say, well, I don't really understand why the collection department's even calling me. I gave you all this information. I told you I had no knowledge of these debts, and now you're trying to collect. And I even had one creditor go as far as to tell me, well, it's your credit then. If you're not going to work with me, it's your credit. And then he hung up on me. And sure enough, I've actually had my credit score just plummet. I've had credit card companies that I was, you know, we don't have very much credit in our name, which was easy to figure out what didn't belong there. So, but some of the ones that we did have actually sent us letters now saying, we're going to raise your interest rate. And by no fault of our own, we've been current on all of our payments. Our debts have, you know, we've always made really good on our debts. So this is something that's affecting not just myself, but my husband's credit as well. And it's not done. I don't think it's done, and I don't think we're far from being done. I think we're still going to be dealing with this. It's my understanding that that even if I was to try and sue these credit card companies for the harassment and the ruining of my credit, that if they were to be found, in the right and myself in the wrong, then I would be the one that would have to actually pay the fees of filing a case against them, the attorney fees and the court fees, their attorney fees as well. So that would absolutely bankrupt me. There's no way. So,
Representative Holby, members of the committee, again, my name is Keith Carnes, and identity theft is not that hard to identify when you have the right documents. As you would imagine, people who go around stealing other people's identity and running up debts aren't in the practice of repaying those debts. And so in the case of Ms. Collet here, there were a bunch of debts that were charged up in an address in Seattle, Washington, and then there were all the that didn't have any payments made on them. Charges were run up instantly, and they were all incurred in Washington. In the meantime, Ms. Collet and her husband, who are making their payments on all the debts that were incurred here in Polk County, are all current and have low balances and weren't charged up just immediately and forgotten about. We see this over and over again. One client of mine lived here locally and had all of his personal identifiable information stolen in Tampa, Florida. And so he's being dunned and collected upon by cable companies and cell phone companies that were providing service in Tampa.
he lived in the area for years and years. There's no way this could have been him. And despite that, he's still being collected upon. He was collected upon. You know, I take a much more cautious approach than Mr. Baxter does on these cases. I advise my clients it's not in their best interest to bring them. That unless we have an absolute clear violation of the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act that seems completely ironclad, it should not be brought, because the problems that Mr. Baxter described with judges requiring debtors to pay the attorney fees, not because the case was brought to harass, but because there was a failure of proof, because the law was interpreted against the consumer instead of for the consumer. And so for those reasons, I think that Senate Bill 386 is very important and should be passed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carnes, I think some of this could be transpiring because of the illegal immigration that's going on, because I know there's lots of people using other people's social security numbers to get jobs, things like that, and why we're seeing so much fraud right now.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that hasn't been my experience. I have not seen that myself, except in one case, and that was where the IRS started to intercept my client's tax refunds by saying, you have all this income in Chicago and all this income in Salem, and you aren't doing the proper withholdings on the Chicago income. It wasn't where they started being collected upon by a creditor. I haven't seen that personally. I don't know if I could intelligently speculate on how often it happens.
Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Carnes, terrible case. Thank you for coming to tell us about your situation today. So, this doesn't really take care of her situation, does it? I mean, all it does is stop the debt collectors from harassing her. Am I missing something here?
Chair Holvey, Representative Tomei, the law doesn't let somebody collect a debt from a victim of identity theft just because it was taken out in their name. The law as it exists today protects Ms. Collet. Capital One or the credit union or the debt collector or anybody cannot collect from her a debt that her ex-husband incurred in her name. So the law is already in place. It's clear that she doesn't have to pay the debt. The question is, when they keep collecting it, what do we do about it? When they use that wrench of the credit report and the calls at work and the threats and the hostile tactics, what is Ms. Collet left to do? And unfortunately, the answer is, in Oregon, I'm of the opinion that if it's a debt collector, we sue them under the Fair Debt Collection Practice Act, which is a federal law which only has the attorney fees as Senator Bonamici described. But if it's an original creditor, if it's Capital One doing this, then you just file a complaint with whoever will listen to you and just know that if there are enough complaints out there, they may do something or they may not. But there's nothing for Ms. Collet to do but do her best to shrug it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews.
You know, I'll pass in the interest of time right now, Chair Holvey. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Widener, another question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had one prompted here. Right now, when a debt collector is harassing you, if you tell them to stop calling you, don't they have to stop at that point? I believe that's the way the law reads.
Representative Widener, I'm sorry, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, that is the way the Fair Debt Collection, the federal law, works. That if it's a third-party collector, somebody who took over the debt when it was alleged to have been in default, the federal law gives you the absolute right to not be contacted. The debt collector can still sue you, garnish your wages, do other collection, but they can't keep billing you and calling you. And so that's the federal law, yes. There's a grave imbalance between the state and federal law in that aspect right now.
Other questions? Not seeing any today. I appreciate you coming forward and Ms. Collet, I appreciate you coming forward and sharing your story with the committee. The examples are oftentimes helpful for us. I appreciate it. So up next, I'd like to have Jim Markey and Paul Cosgrove. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis. I'm here today representing my client, the Oregon Collectors Association, as well as the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, both of whom are opposed to the A. and Gross Senate Bill 386. I've handed out some written testimony for you to read at your convenience, and I won't bore you by reading it. But I do want to try to bring a little context to this issue before I get into specifics about the bill. The federal government, through Congress, enacted the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act under federal law in the mid-70s. And that bill, as it passed through Congress, when it was introduced, it applied to everybody collecting a debt, and eventually everybody was exempted out of the bill except third-party debt collectors, collection agencies. And so that bill passed, and collection agencies were regulated under the federal act. And later, under the federal act, debt buyers were added, as well as attorneys who are collecting debts for another person. So those are the only people covered under the federal act: third-party debt collectors, my client, collection agencies in Oregon, debt buyers, and attorneys collecting for a third party. That law is administered by the Federal Trade Commission, and there have been lots of actions brought. It also contains a right of private action, I believe, for $1,000 or actual damages together with attorney fees, etc. The Oregon Act was enacted by the state legislature in, I believe, 1979, and I was here and helped write the act, and it was, as Senator Bonamici described, modeled after the federal act. The federal act has changed over the course of time, and there have been some amendments to the state act. The major difference between the state act and the federal act is that when adopted by the Oregon legislature and continuously since, the Oregon act applies to anyone collecting a debt in Oregon, be it a first-party debt collector or a third-party debt collector or a debt buyer or an attorney, anybody. So, and we felt that it was supported by us as adopted, and we felt that all consumers deserved equal protection under the law. The Oregon Act, for a number of years, only had a right of private action, and no state agency oversaw this activity on behalf of consumers as they experienced debt collection activity. So, as you know, Senate Bill 328 this session passed. The Attorney General now has authority over this act. We think the present act is pretty adequate, but wouldn't be opposed to looking at changes to the act as they might be needed. But I really think that the biggest danger you face in changing this act are unintended consequences. And I believe the people that wrote this Senate bill are well-intentioned, and certainly I don't want to see debtors harassed by debt collectors. And if I catch my clients doing it, I'll kick them. But I believe that my clients in Oregon try to follow the law. I think it becomes very complicated as you are subject to a federal law as well as a state law, and my clients are the only people here that are subject to both laws. Specifically, what this bill does is very interesting, and I want to respond a little bit to what Mr. Baxter said, and I want to direct your attention to page 3, lines 3 through 5, the present law under 646-639 sub K already prevents someone for attempting or threatening to enforce a right or remedy with knowledge or reason to know that the right or remedy does not exist. Now, the courts have construed that under Porter versus Hill to mean that you still have the right to take an action, to bring an action, and bringing an action in and of itself under Porter versus Hill, even though it later determined that the debt was for a different amount that you brought or didn't exist, but you didn't know it, is not a violation of the Act in and of itself. Thomas versus U.S. Bank that Mr. Baxter alluded to, his client, the judge in that case ruled that his client wasn't entitled to remedy under their lawsuit because of the precedence of Porter versus Hill. I don't know if that was a proper determination by the judge or not, but Mr. Baxter has that case under appeal now, and so a higher court will make that decision. What the amendment to sub K probably does is to overturn Porter versus Hill. Now, whether it does or not will be determined by a court of law, and I can't tell you that it will or won't, but I think that there is some likelihood that it will be overturned. And if you take that in conjunction with the language on page 2, lines 12 and 13, what the proponents of this bill have written in here is a general prohibition on any false or misleading statement to a debtor. And that really sounds good on the surface. But because it is a broad general statement of false or misleading and is an automatic violation, becomes an automatic violation if you make any false statement to a debtor. Well, many of these debts are disputed. And so if a debt collector asks, sends a letter asking for $5,000, and the debtor says, I only owe $4,500, and it's later determined that, or it's settled at $45 or $48, that letter asking for $5,000 under this law could become a false statement. And with that, then, the debt collector is in violation of the Act. Now, the Act has a willful standard, as Mr. Baxter and Mr. Carnes stated to you. And that's great, but the courts have ruled, and I don't have that citation in front of me, but I have it here, the courts have ruled that the term willful under this Act includes ordinary negligence, a newer or should have known standard. And unlike the federal act, there is no exception for a bona fide error. The federal act that regulates basically these same kinds of things has a provision in it that says if a debt collector makes a bona fide error, it's not a violation. We have nothing like that here. We have a willful standard that the courts have said includes ordinary negligence, and so you could, on any of these disputed debts, if you ask for something that later you settle for something different for, it's a false statement and it's a violation, and you're subject to a lawsuit, and you're also subject now to enforcement by the Attorney General. And then on page 3, lines 19 through 21, this bill brings in the federal act, and it simply says that any violation of this federal act that I just talked about is also an automatic violation of the state act. Well, in Oregon, when we refer to, when one statute refers to a different statute, another statute, and says this other statute is also brought in, there, statutorily we say that that includes that law, the referred to statute as it exists today, and with all future amendments. But in, with respect to reference to a federal act, we can only apply that to the federal act as it exists on the day the reference is made, because to do anything different would be unconstitutional. It would be, the Supreme Court has ruled that's an unlawful delegation of authority by you to the federal government. And so what this will mean is that a violation of the federal act as it exists on the day this becomes law will be a violation of the state act. But if that federal act is amended later or reinterpreted by the Federal Trade Commission, which it is done monthly, they have new interpretations of this federal law, then those new interpretations will not be a violation of the state act. And so somebody's going to have to sort that out. And in fact, what might be legal in the future that is not legal on the day that this becomes law could be a violation of this state act as a result of this reference. And I would just submit to you that that misses the mark in terms of protection of consumers and is not necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Markey. I'm going to have to move on to Mr. Cosgrove. I've only got about 5 minutes left for you, Mr. Cosgrove, and I got one other person to testify. If you have anything to add.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I'm here on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, all the financial institutions, and I won't repeat any of the things that Mr. Markey said, but we share concerns. I would just point out that this law has been in existence in Oregon since 1979 with these current provisions that are proposed to be amended now, and I do not think there's been a case made that what has happened in that 30-year period is dramatically different than what the legislature considered back in 1979, and we are concerned about the possibility of unintended consequences, and in particular, encouraging litigation for what are mistakes made in good faith by people about the amount due and owing being different than what is claimed in the collection letter. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I will leave it at that.
Sure. Thank you.
Question. Paul, you said you don't think there have been a lot of changes since 1979, and I'm wondering, do you think there's been more identity theft than there might have been in 79?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, excuse me. Yes, that's clearly a change in the circumstance, and in fact, we also have a worse economy now than we've had in almost every year since then. But I think the law and its provisions have stood the test of time as striking the appropriate balance between protecting against unintended consequences and lawsuits that shouldn't be brought versus giving consumers the right to make claims against harassment. No one would defend the kinds of harassment kinds of phone calls. Those are clearly illegal now, and this bill isn't necessary to address that issue. The law already does so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Just one. I mean, the case was brought up that though these practices may be against the law, it doesn't seem that there's any recourse for stopping them by a particular consumer. We just heard testimony from three people up here that the law was being violated, but there was no remedy for that consumer to get the debt collection practices turned around. So, I mean, how do you answer that?
Mr. Chair, I think you answered it in Senate Bill 328. You gave the Attorney General enforcement power.
Certainly, Senate Bill 328 gives some ability for the Attorney General to take action, but as you know, in the Unfair Trade Practices Act, they don't necessarily take on a case of an individual consumer. They take action, you know, based upon a pattern of practice by a particular industry or business, and not based on an individual's complaint. So they don't really take on a case for an individual consumer.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But again, with respect to even the case that Mr. Baxter brought, They did bring an action, and it's still under appeal, and I don't, you know, I'm not particularly fond of the remedy that they received by the judge, but it is under appeal, and it may be different before it's over. So,
all right, thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Angela Martin and Sybil Hebb. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee.
And we do just have a few minutes left. So.
Perfect. You'll have testimony from not only myself, but testimony from Sybil Hebb coming out before you again. My name is Angela Martin with Our Oregon. Happy to be here today in support of Senate Bill 386. A couple of points that I think are important to emphasize at this point. First, let's remind ourselves that evidence is such that abusive debt collection tactics are persistent and a growing problem. That's why these bills are necessary. People are falling behind. We have record high defaults and at the same time a record surge in the number of abusive debt collection practices. Certainly strong debt collection laws are not a way out or a free ride for consumers. Instead, the goal is to protect consumers from overly aggressive tactics as they seek to make good on their debt. Interesting to note that Harvard Law professor and bankruptcy expert Elizabeth Warren in a recent interview explained that abusive debt collection tactics prompt many consumers to actually file for bankruptcy because they simply want to stop the phone calls. And that is the one way that they see they are able to stop the abuse and the harassment. So it's these types of strong consumer protection laws that will actually put people in a better position to make good on their debt without suffering undue harassment. A few provisions of this bill that are worth noting. Number one, the prohibit the use of false or misleading statements. As part of an in-depth report on debt, MSNBC found multiple examples of employees from national debt collection companies making use of false and misleading statements as a regular tactic. Employees would pretend to have arrest warrants or claim to be working directly with military investigators. They would claim to be in positions of authority that they weren't actually in, impersonate attorneys. I cited this in-depth report because it's actually pretty illuminating, not only for the tactics that are being employed, but at the end of this report, the segment ends with an interview with one of the representatives from a national industry trade organization, who, upon looking at the investigations and the on-camera interviews, conceded that if this type of abuse is happening in her industry, they need to protect good actors by tightening regulations. So it's an opportunity and an example of industry representatives saying we need to weed out the most abusive debt collectors in this. Opponents of Senate Bill 386, we just heard, allege that the attorney fee provisions would open up the doors to frequent and questionable lawsuits. I think it's reasonable to expect that if there had been an extensive or unreasonable lawsuits prior to the law shifting in 1995, those types of examples would have been brought forth for us to review and understand. We didn't see those types of examples. We also don't see those types of examples in other states that have abusive and extensive lawsuits being filed. It's worth noting that a recent review of consumer protection statutes across this country, and this is particularly a review of the unlawful trade practice statutes, find that Oregon is one of three states that puts consumers on the hook if they go to court, sue, and lose. This acts as a deterrent to effective enforcement. The Attorney General is not there to hear individual cases for consumers. Consumers' access to civil justice depends on being able to have their day in court. The false and misleading example that Mr. Marquis brought up is exactly what the bad faith provision is intended to protect against, suggesting that someone would go to court to allege that they only owed $4,800 when that creditor asked for $5,000 is on its face an abusive and harassing lawsuit being filed, and again, exactly what the bad faith provision of this attorney provision is intended to protect against. We continue to hear a lot about these issues and the pressure of balancing between a consumer's need to have safeguards in the law and the creditor's right to have fair payment. We're going to continue to hear about these, and I think Senate Bill 386 strikes a good and fair balance on how to make sure we're all well protected in this process. Thank you very much for your time. I recognize that we're running late, so I'm going to close it with those comments.
Representative Bradley, very quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been looking at this an awful long time now, and I'm still concerned about some unintended consequences. I think this can be, there are things that could be worked out with this, but I think there are a couple of things in here that bother me, and I'm hoping that we can maybe fix this before we go on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I would let you know, if you come into my committee ever and accuse somebody of false and misleading statements, I think that's improper. Testify to the facts as you see them and don't impugn somebody else, because you won't get much sympathy out of me.
Any other comments? Not hearing any. Thank you for your testimony. Committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 386A. And with that, what do we have on Wednesday? Committee, on Wednesday, we have Senate Bill 377A, Senate Bill 623, Senate Bill 771, and Senate Bill 929A. With that, I am adjourning the House Committee on Consumer Protection.